Welcome to another edition of the Super Floyd Podcast, your Rococo NBA podcast. I'm your host, Joe Borelli, as always, and it is Monday, December 19th, 2016. Welcome back, friends. Sorry I missed you about a week there. Plans get switched around, and I've got a lot on my plate these days, and sometimes I just don't have time to do this labor of love that I like to call it. And come hang out with you guys, hang out with my friends. So, sorry about that. I'll try and do this more regularly. But, the holidays are coming up and, we got to go see family. We're going to be traveling, as I'm sure most of you are as well. Buying gifts and, at work, man. Work has been ridiculously hectic. You know, trying to not only do the daily day-to-day things, but I'm also trying to set up for the time when we're not there. So, I'm, going to be on vacation the week between Christmas and New Year's, and, things still have to run without me. I'm not tooting my own horn, I'm just saying. Things still have to run, and so I have to make sure things are in place to run. And I know you don't know what I do for a living, but it's fine, you don't need to. Let's just say that it's very detail-oriented, and need to make sure that things get to be where they're going, and coming and going, and making sure that whatever, it doesn't matter. How's things, guys and gals, in podcast land? Have you been listening to good podcasts lately? I hope so. I have. I always have my standards, my NBA ones, and then This American Life, and Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I love, and Marc Maron. I'm just rambling. But, I thought maybe you'd like to hear it. So let's talk about me. Let's talk about my mental state these days. Do I sound down? I shouldn't. Life is fine. Things are great. 2016 has been a fucking pisser of a year, man. We've lost a lot of people. We lost Prince. We lost David Bowie. We lost Zsa Zsa Gabor yesterday. We lost, our president, who I love dearly, and very tense and unsure and scared for the future of this country right now. But aside from that, we've lost a lot of good celebrities. Not just celebrities, but people in our personal lives have, everyone's been, so, all right, so this is what I'm getting to. Let me just stop. Everyone has been touched by this horrible, horrible thing, cancer. I don't think there's anybody in this country or world, really, that hasn't been affected by, the tragedy of cancer and taking loved ones often way too soon. And the NBA family is no different. This past week, Craig Sager passed away from cancer, and I'm not going to eulogize him because I didn't know the man. I really enjoyed his colorful outfits, and he seemed like an excellent human being on the sideline reporting. So, my condolences go out to him and his family, or his family, and there were a lot of NBA tributes. A lot of people think that, Steve Kerr did a great job with his tribute to him. And, I'm not even going to talk about it much. I'm just going to say that, it's sad, and he was a fighter, and I think that's what he's going to be known for, aside from his, reporting on the sideline, and his rapport with Greg Popovich, which we all loved. It's just sad. It's we've all been touched by this horrible thing, and, I don't even know what to say. I feel bad for everyone involved, but I think the important thing is in life, we always, we mourn the loss of loved ones, and it's a really hard, tragic thing. And it's something that you never really get over. And they, especially people that are very close to you, and they're part of the fabric of your being, of what makes you you. And when you take that away, it's really tough to overcome. But I think we also need to remember that, these people, if they meant so much to us, we really need to celebrate their lives and celebrate what they were and what they did. And, and the positive things they brought to this world. You know, I don't know. I should just stop talking about this altogether. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not skilled at saying things in general, or I shouldn't be. This isn't fun. This isn't funny. I should keep this lighthearted. But anyway, Craig Sager, you will be missed. And that's all. Hopefully 2017 is better, although I doubt it. Then 2016 has been for all of our mental states. Yeah, that's all. I got not much. I found out one thing last week that, you know, you should never, if you're going to go run outdoors in the cold, and you think that, like, your spandex will just operate as a set of underwear if you're going to wear shorts over top of them, don't do it. There's lots of chafing that happens. It's not fun. It's not a good experience. I don't recommend it. I don't think I'll ever do it again. You know what I was thinking? I was like, well, you know, it's the day was like moderately warm and it was kind of nice out. And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I don't want to dirty another pair of underwear when I'm just going to go, you know, just go for an hour run. And like, you know, this is a gross subject. I'm sorry, but chafing, man, chafing. It's an awful thing. It's awful. It's fucking horrible. Don't always wear something. Always wear something. You know, I didn't think, like, I always hear about people doing marathons and stuff and running long distances, and they have problems with their nipples. And okay, so when I did the half marathon this year, here's my thing. I don't normally have problems with my nipples roughing or shaving because, like, I, you know, whatever. It just doesn't occur for me, I guess. I did during the marathon, the half marathon, because I pinned my freaking thing to my chest and I had one of the pins right on my left nipple. Oh my God, that hurt so bad. After 13 miles, having a metal bar rub, but anyway, sorry. You should always, but the point of the matter is you should always wear protective garments underneath the garments that you're wearing, just to be sure that you're not going to experience some discomfort in the long run. I'm glad I went from talking about death and cancer to talking about chafing. I'm all over the place today, but you know, I just wanted to say, hi guys, this is my life. Welcome to my crazy world. It's not that crazy. And I've missed you, and I hope you missed me too. Anyway, so tonight I have Trevor Magnotti coming on, and we're going to talk about the Cavs, the Cleveland Cavaliers, and their chances at repeating at the championship. And we're going to preview a little bit of their Christmas Day game with the Warriors. And we're going to, just talk about LeBron's historic season and all things Cavs. So this is the point in the show where I tell you, if you don't like the Cleveland Cavaliers, maybe tune out. I hope my opening diatribe didn't go too short for you. I know you're so interested in the things that I have to say in my interesting life. Anyway, that's all. But, you know, I also, you know what, here's one more thing. And this is actually NBA related. I asked, or I tweeted out, you know, if you guys don't follow along with the show on Twitter, you can follow at Superflight Pod, at Superflight Pod. And when I tweeted out last week, because I knew this was going to get pushed back and rescheduled, I said, well, I was thinking about doing a show last week by myself, and it's really difficult for me to do one of these by myself. I do like to ramble, but my thoughts are honestly not that coherent, and they kind of weave in and out in case you hadn't noticed. But I asked for listener questions, and I said, if you want to hear me talk about something, if you want me to do my own podcast by myself, hit me up with a question, and I will answer it. So I did get one that I want to answer, and it comes from my good friend. Oh, by the way, shout out again to the Fuzz NBA podcast in Australia. I don't know if you guys listened to last week, but Michael Keith came on and we talked, and we had a really good time. Hung out in New York and spent some time together, me and my wife and him and his lady. And it was a blast and awesome dude. And I highly recommend you check the Fuzz out. Those guys are freaking awesome. Also, yeah, I get some really good stories about Byron James, Michael's partner in crime. I can't share those on the air, but just let me tell you, they make these guys so much cooler. Some of the most hilarious bits of information I've ever received. Awesome. Awesome stories. Awesome guys. Highly recommend checking them out. Anyway, got a question from Michael Harris at Obuck Vintage. And the question is, should the Sixers make it their mission to have a better record than the Wolves or tank for a better pick? And cool, I'll answer the question as best as I can because, you know, whatever, this is what I do. They're not in direct competition, so it's a little bit, not a weird question, it's just, I think it's building a sort of rivalry that's not there. So that's fine, but should they get a better pick? Well, here's the thing. I don't think that the Sixers are going to finish better than the top three anyway. And I really wouldn't worry about them like getting bad for the sake of another pick. They're kind of in a sort of tumultuous situation with Nerlens Noel right now, which is a whole different conversation. But I think that he's a little bit of a locker room cancer. And up until last night, the last couple games when they were trying to start Joel Embiid and Okafor together, it's not going to work. It's just a shit show there. So honestly, if they keep trying to do this experiment when it's starting the Twin Towers, I don't think they're going to have to worry about trying to get a better pick. So really, I think the question is, should the Sixers try and play better or should they try and get worse? The direct competition with the Wolves doesn't really exist, but I kind of get it. Especially since like the Wolves, I think for a bit of the Sixers fandom, the Wolves picks of Karl-Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, we felt like should have probably been ours those last two seasons just because the Sixers were bad and the balls just didn't roll their way. You know, that's the luck of the lottery. It's fine. And that was Sam Hinkie's plan was that, Nick, you need to maximize your luck. And I think that was the whole idea is that you're not always going to hit on a Karl-Anthony Towns. You're not always going to hit on Andrew Wiggins. But if you gamble enough, you're going to hit on something. And I think he did that perfectly with Joel Embiid. And nobody knew that he would actually play. We were all hoping. I don't think anybody saw him being this good. And so I'm not upset so much anymore about the Karl-Anthony Towns thing and the Andrew Wiggins thing. I did, you know, piss me off a little bit there, especially when like local Philadelphia media was all, you know, shitting on Sam for like these supposed bad picks. I think honestly, the only one that he made that was bad was Jahlil Okafor. And my God, I wish they would get him off this team. Here's the tragedy about Nerlens Noel being disgruntled right now. And sorry, again, I'm all over the place on this, but he's been benched now, even though he's healthy. He's just a healthy scratch because he didn't keep his mouth shut. And it's the team's right to do that. And it's Noel's right to be pissed because he's way better of a player than Jahlil Okafor and B than to be coming off the bench like in sporadic moments. The real tragedy is for me is that we're never going to get to see Joel Embiid and Nerlens Noel play together. I would have really liked to see what that pairing looked like just for the defensive potential. They would have been ball hawking, like dominating in the paint. Not necessarily ball hawking on the perimeter, but I don't think you would have gotten anybody in the paint anywhere near them. And then they both have quick enough, well, especially Noel, his hands are so supremely quick and like he's so good at steals and just his lateral movement, his lateral quickness is so damn good. So fast, but I he's quick enough to cover the perimeter in spots, as is Embiid a little bit. I don't think it would work overall for long periods of time. Like offensively, you have two centers playing together, but I think that matchup would be way better than Okafor. I just want Okafor off this team. I'm sure I don't have anything against Okafor personally. I'm sure he's going to be great for another team. This is not the one, and I wish if they're going to trade Noel, just send Okafor with him already. This needs to be Joel Embiid's team. Anyway, getting back to the question at hand, sorry about that. Yeah, I don't. So again, there's no direct competition with the Wolves, especially since the Wolves are in the West and the Sixers are in the East, and like they have nothing to gain from beating the Wolves, and the Wolves have nothing to gain from beating them other than just pure record and lottery standings. Although I think a lot of people thought that the Wolves would be so much better than they are this year, and me included. I didn't know that they would make the playoffs, but I definitely thought they were going to be better than their record, which is what, 7-20 now or something? Or that's the Sixers record, but it's very near that. So I think just for pride's sake, maybe that's what we're talking about. Yeah, I would say, listen, I would love the Sixers. Here's the thing. If Ben Simmons comes back this season and he's healthy and Joel Embiid stays healthy and Ben Simmons is what we think he's going to be, and you've got the opportunity to add another really high pick in this draft this year, I don't really give a shit if that's a top three pick. Honestly, if it's apparently this draft is really loaded with point guards, which is kind of what they need, and maybe perimeter players, like, you know, a shooting guard would be excellent, or a small forward would be amazing. They have enough power forwards and centers. I think that it's weird, too, because both of these teams are not really going to benefit that much from having another high pick. They're both kind of sort of set with the players they got. You can't keep adding first round picks, high first round picks every year. It's just gonna, like we saw, this is what happens when you draft three centers in a row, three really highly touted, very talented centers, and they just don't work together, you know. So like the same thing happens. Anyways, so that said, yeah, I would love it for the Sixers to have a better record than the Wolves, just for pride's sake. I mean, I don't want them to finish like with a 30-win record. I mean, don't get me wrong, as a fan, I always want to see them finish with, you know, a really good record. And I think if they did finish with a 30-win record, that would just say that, man, they've really started to gel. Joel Embiid is amazing. Ben Simmons has come back, and he's also amazing. And there's a huge bright spot for the future. It would be awesome. They're not in direct competition, so I would just say that I think wherever they both land is fine. I don't know if that really answers the question, but thanks for sending it in. Anyway, so I'll stop rambling. I've said enough, and we'll be right back. So, Trevor, welcome to the Superflight Podcast. Why don't you start off by telling everyone where they can follow you and how they can read your stuff.
Hey, how's it going? So you can follow me on Twitter at Illegal Screens. And then you can find my stuff at Fear the Sword. I also write for Fansided for the Step Back, doing European basketball coverage and draft stuff.
So, you know, every time I have a new guest on, I always like to talk about their fandom and how they became a fan of their favorite team. So do you mind telling me how you started following the Cavs and why you write about them?
Yeah, so I kind of took like a backwards route through becoming a Cavs fan. So I went to Ohio University for grad school, and that was right around the time that I was starting to get into basketball blogging. I was basically running this little Tumblr account that had like 100 followers on it. Nice. So at the time I got picked up by Write Down Euclid, Cavs blog on the Fansided Network, which is now King James Gospel, I believe. I got approached by someone at Fansided, and they were like, "We want to offer you a writing position. What team would you like to write for?" And I was like, "Oh, it'll be easy for me to watch Cavs games while I'm in Ohio. I'm going to grad school, so I'll pick the Cavs." And it just kind of fostered naturally from there. Keep in mind, this was back in 2013, so like right in the middle of the Byron Scott era. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't a Cavs fan through the first LeBron run. I wasn't a Cavs fan at the point of the decision. I mean, I liked LeBron. I liked watching the team, but I never really like would have considered myself a fan of them. Growing up in Chicago, I was always kind of a nominal Bulls fan, but, you know, really just like the league at large, and then kind of through that kind of grew organically into a Cavs fan, and really got my education in Cleveland Twitter through those 2 years, just with how bad they were, and kind of how insane it was in the post LeBron era. But now he's back and they won a title, and you know, it's a really kind of took the bet. Took the back door to becoming a fan of the team, and then you know it's kind of surreal to have them win a title, you know,
Yes.
4 years basically after you become a fan of the team.
Well, I wish I could say that about the Sixers, but oh, that's my team. But yeah, you know, what a time to be a fan, man. Like you think you're surprised, you're only a fan for 4 years. They've not had a winning team in whatever, I think. Or at least since when was the last time Cleveland sports won anything? The 30s or something like that?
1964, the Cleveland Browns won an NFL championship.
All right, so the 60s, whatever. but you know, so
It's been
good time to get in, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that's cool. Let's so are you from you just went to school in Cleveland or in Ohio? You're not from Ohio.
No, I'm originally from Chicago.
Oh, right, you just said. The nominal Bulls fan. Sorry, it's been a really long weekend. It's only Monday already. So let's talk about the Cavs. So they're 19-6, right? And then honestly, they look like they're not even trying to win games half the time. They're just like coasting because they're just really that good, I think. And I'm just like, you know, as an NBA fan, like we go into the season wanting to think that like there are teams that are going to be able to challenge, like that everybody has a shot. I mean, it's not like the NFL where there's parity, like and at this point the parity in the NFL is just making everyone bad. But it's not like, you know, any team can challenge. We pretty much know going in that like there's going to be a few teams that are going to be the best in the league, and then those are the ones that are going to vie for the championship. And Cleveland is definitely that. Obviously, since last year, they didn't lose any pieces. They brought the same guys back, and they look just amazing. And if you have LeBron on your team to begin with, you're going to be a damn good team. But like, do you think there's anybody else in the East, like Toronto or Charlotte or the Bulls, maybe Detroit, Boston, Milwaukee, any of these teams, you think anybody could actually give them a run for their money?
I mean, I definitely think Toronto's the one team that's going to give them the biggest challenge come playoff time. The Cavs have won the 3 games in the season series this year, but they've all been pretty close. And that team just matches up pretty well with the Cavs. They've got size inside, which the Cavs do not, and they can use guys like Jonas Valanciunas and to really kind of carve out the middle of the Cavs defense, which has kind of been a soft spot. They've got multiple isolation scorers. They've got a bunch of nice, long, athletic defensive players that can handle the Cavs wings. They rotate really well to cover open shooters. And you know, when a team, they might not be the best defensive team, but when their kind of calling card is defending the type of play that the Cavs try to run as their bread and butter, kind of swinging passes around the outside, looking for open shooters, and then you know, if they can't find anything, driving to the rim, the Raptors are pretty good at defending both of those, so they're able to really do a good job of sticking with this team on the defensive end. I just think their talent level is high enough to really or to really give them a challenge. And the you know, it's a matchup that the Cavs don't have a super don't have a super strong advantage in. Like you said Charlotte. Charlotte's a really, really good team, but for whatever reason over the past 3 years, they've had no chance anytime that they played the Cavs, just because it's a bad matchup. They don't have you know, they don't have a really good offensive game plan for the way that the Cavs defend. The Cavs can take advantage of their defense through driving and through hitting some of those pick and pop plays, like Kevin Love and Channing Frye. And for whatever reason, they just destroy the Hornets a majority of the time that they play, that the teams play each other. So, you know, I'm not really worried about Charlotte. Not really worried about Boston, just because you know they don't have the defense this year that really I think is going to be able to stop Cleveland. It's really just Toronto that I'd be worried about as a potential challenge for the Cavs in the East.
Yeah, I would maybe throw Detroit in there too, because they also have that inside size game, you know, that could give Cleveland problems. But they just don't seem to be able to put it together this year right now for some reason. But so, and they, you know, Toronto has played Cleveland, what you said, three times already or twice, and they can't seem to get over the hump. So I'm just like wondering, like, what is it that Toronto could do? What are they missing? I mean, aside from the fact that they're missing LeBron, who's probably one of the top five greatest players of all time, you know, what would they need to do to get over that hump? What do you think would need to happen for somebody to, besides LeBron being out with an injury, what would be the thing? I mean, like, Toronto right now has a really great offense. They have the best offense in the league, and I think their second unit with I forget what they're calling it now, the lineup of extinction or something like that. somebody coined this cute phrase. Like, they're better than the Golden State Warriors were last year with their death lineup. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's going to pan out for the entire season. It seems like it's probably going to regress a bit. But they're really good on offense. And still, they just can't seem to get over the hump to beat Cleveland in any way. What would it take for them to do it? What are they missing?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with, you know, you jokingly said they don't have LeBron, but the biggest problem for them is they don't have a matchup for LeBron on the defensive end. You know, his ability to play on the perimeter and drive, you know, basically as, you know, a combo guard type of player, doing that at like 6'9", Toronto just doesn't have really the size and length on the wing to be able to handle him. I mean, they have Damari Carroll, but since he's come to Toronto, he's kind of been a little or he's either been injured or just kind of out of sorts, and he just, it's a bad matchup when he's on LeBron. I mean, they've got guys like Norman Powell, they've got Terrence Ross, DeRozan's a pretty good defender. They can stick with most of the other guys on the perimeter for the Cavs. The problem is the Cavs can go small against them with LeBron at the four, and they just don't have an answer for that. They don't have a guy who can defend him competently, as well as defend all of the other shooters around the floor. And I think that's kind of their biggest issue. If I was Toronto and I was looking at, you know, what type of player could I potentially add at the trade deadline to, you know, really give them the advantage over in the Cleveland matchup, you know, I'm looking to a guy who's longer than a guy like DeRozan, a guy who can play on LeBron a majority of the time and switch onto the quicker guards, and potentially guard up to Kevin Love. They just really don't have like that positionless defender, like an Andre Iguodala type, that you need to really give the Cavs issues. They're really sound kind of 1-5 defensively at those spots, but it's when you get that flexibility in your lineups, especially when you go small, that gives them issues, because Valanciunas can't guard on the perimeter. Patrick Patterson, he can, but he can't defend the quickest guys out there. Pascal Siakam, he can defend those guys, but he's A, a rookie, and B, is going to give you nothing on the offensive end if you have to play him big minutes.
Right.
They're really missing a guy who can kind of cover up multiple positions and just kind of fill in wherever they need against Cleveland, because right now, you know, they're just a little bit limited on the defensive side of things.
Right. And, you know, it's not just them, though. Like, every team in the league has matchup problems when it comes to LeBron. Nobody has a guy that can guard him. Nobody can guard him. It's just, he is that guy. He's unguardable. I mean, even Iguodala, you mentioned, he does a really fantastic job on LeBron as much as he can.
Mm-hmm.
But even Iguodala can't stop him. Like, nobody can stop LeBron. And I think that's, you know, until he's over the hill or until he, like, starts taking a step back, I don't know, man. I mean, he's been to, what, 6 straight finals now? There's mm-hmm. just – he's automatically just putting your team in the playoffs at least – at the very least, and, you know, and most likely the championship. He's just that good. I mean, and it's just kind of unfair. I guess it's sort of the same thing that happened when Michael Jordan was in the league, right? There was really great teams. Like, Barkley was a really great player, and he just could not get past Jordan. He just couldn't do it. I mean, like, I guess they only met in the championship once, but yeah, man, like, you know, I don't even, like, that's the thing. Like, what do you do? Like, you'd have to have some really great scheme to be able to combat him. And I don't know if there's anybody in the East that can do it. I mean, the only team that seems to match up to me is the Warriors, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, you know, you're not so much making it so that LeBron's stopped. You just have to make him work. You really just have to make him kind of grind out possessions. You have to make him figure out ways to beat you consistently, because if you can get him away from his normal game, if you can get him away from, you know, dribbling a few times, firing up a three, or, you know, being able to find the weak spot in whatever perimeter defender is guarding him, and, you know, either shooting from outside or getting into the lane, I really think that that's when you have the advantage. When you can start forcing him into the post, when you can start forcing the Cavs to rely on him as a screener instead of a ball handler,
mm-hmm.
those are the things that, you know, give you the advantage, because while they're still going to have success because of who LeBron is and who they have around him, it's not going to be as efficient as when they're doing what they want to do. And that's what we've seen in the playoffs so far in these last 2 years, is the teams who have challenged the Cavs the most are the teams who can get them deviated away from what they want to do. The most prominent example of that is the Hawks. I mean, the Hawks let the Cavs for 2 years in a row do everything that they possibly wanted to do on the offensive end. They let them move the ball at will. They let them drive to the lane. They let them out rebound them on the offensive end. Everything that the Hawks did defensively was basically saying, okay, the Cavs are going to do this. Well, we're going to defend that, and we're going to react to what they're doing. That's kind of what it felt like. Whereas teams mm-hmm. like the Raptors and teams like the Warriors that have given the Cavs issues, you know, they've done a good job of figuring out ways to make LeBron beat them in ways that aren't his bread and butter. And that's the way that you're going to get games against this Cavaliers team. If you can get them out of sync offensively, that's your biggest weapon, because they're not going to do that to you on the defensive end. They're not going to turn around and be able to really do that. The Cavs defensively, really their biggest go-to is we're gonna out physical you on the defensive end, and that's kind of how they try to disrupt. They don't really have the schematic moves to really make a huge difference. So if you can put them in a little bit of a bind strategically on the offensive end, you're gonna win that efficiency, or you're gonna get a better shot at winning that efficiency battle.
Right. Well, you know, since we're speaking of LeBron's greatness, let me mention the fact that so LeBron just passed Elvin Hayes for the 9th all-time in scoring, right? 27,000 points, which is a ton of points. And I think he's the youngest to crack the top 10 in scoring. Is that right?
Yep.
And then he went on and just reached the he was the only player ever to reach the 7,000 assists, 27,000 points mark, and 7,000 rebounds. So this is an incredible feat. And he's still only, what, 32? This is like his 14th season, I think?
Mm-hmm.
Man, like, what would it take for him to be considered the greatest of all time at this point?
Yeah, I mean, he's got a great shot at the scoring title, which is which I think he's got to average like 21 or 22 points per game over the next 7 years, playing at like 74 to 70, 76 games a season, which is doable. It's what he's done basically every season of his career. And I think he'll be able to, at least approach that. He's got a few more years of averaging around 24, 25 points per game, even if he dips off, at the end.
Right.
So, he's got that part. He's got the rings. Kobe fans and Jordan fans, they can make the argument of three versus five or three versus six all you want. But, I mean, he's been in the finals 6 or 8 years and went to another finals with potentially the worst finals roster outside of him that we've ever seen.
Right.
07 Cavs team. So I think the winning argument has been settled. He's won enough. To be in this conversation. I think he's the best passer of any of the true elites, because I think that you can put his passing on par with Magic Johnson. I think the only reason that his assist numbers are a little bit are much lower than Magic is Magic played primarily as a point guard for his entire career. Mm-hmm. So of course he was going to average 10, 11, 12 assists per game when he had that level of passing ability. LeBron has the same exact type of passing ability. He's that good, and we've seen it this year. He's averaging 9.0 assists per game, which is a career high. I'm not sure off the top of my head where he is on the leaderboard for this season in assists. He's sixth in the entire league in assists, and he's basically playing as the Cavs point guard, but a 6'9", 250-pound dude who's basically built like a power forward is sixth in the league in assists.
Right.
That's insane.
It's insane. I mean, part of the reason he's so goddamn good and has been for so long is just his physical makeup. Like, You could only make him in like a lab, right? Like he's like an NBA 2K player. Like let's make the best player ever, and you're gonna make him LeBron every time. Like he can guard 1 through 5. It's insane. He has the passing ability of like your elite point guards. Yeah, it's crazy. And I think honestly, like if we're judging him by titles, that seems at this point to be sort of a superficial way to judge a person's greatness. You know what I mean? Like. I mean, he's been there so many times. He hasn't won them all, but like, does it really matter? Like, after you get three, does it really matter? I mean, like, we've seen the feats he's done on the court. We've seen the teams he's taken to the finals. Like, what else does the man need to do? He's setting records like every year, and yeah, he's still so far from. I mean, I know it's premature to talk about it because his career is not over. He's got another like 5 or 6 years left, at least, right?
Mm-hmm. At least.
Yeah, at least. And so by the time he's done, you got to imagine, like we were talking a little bit about the scoring record. Like, if he either averages 22 points a game for the next, would you say 6 years?
It's 6 or 7. I can't remember.
Right. So he's averaging 25 right now. Like, you got to imagine the next 4 or 5 years, he'll still keep averaging like 25, which I think is like pretty standard for him, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think he has a real shot at getting this. Well, I don't know. The scoring title is going to be a tough one, but I think he's got a shot. And if he does that, suppose he does that and he never gets another title. Do we still like, is that still how we're going to, I know Kareem is the scoring leader, right? And we don't consider him the greatest of all time, but I'm just wondering, like, is that what we really measure our greatest of all time by, like the number of championships they've got?
Yeah, I mean it's a really superficial argument, especially when you're looking at LeBron. I mean, he is without a doubt the most physically imposing player that we have ever seen in the league. I mean, he just the amount of things that he can do for his size is insane. And that, I think, is the difference in what separates him from, you know, everybody else at his position. That's what puts him above a guy like Larry Bird. That's what puts him ahead of a guy like Kobe Bryant for me, is the fact that, you know, he's a guy who's playing on the wing a majority of the time, and he's averaging between 6 and 8 rebounds per game. He's averaging between 6 and 9 assists per game. He's dumping in 25 to 30 points a game. He's a decent to good 3-point shooter. He's one of the best finishers we've ever seen at the rim. He's a really good defender when he's locked in. He's not really at that elite level before, but you know, in his absolute prime, you weren't scoring on him. Really, the only weakness in his game, I think, is free throw shooting. And, you know, I'm talking about a little bit of a weakness there. He's a 74% career free throw shooter.
Right.
I mean, if he was up in like the 77, 78 range, I mean, you look at his basketball reference page and it's like, okay, find the hole.
Right.
Like, where is the problem that you have in his statistical profile? Because, you know, just I just don't see it. And I think that's what puts him on this level, I think, is, you know, he doesn't have all the titles that guys like Jordan have. He doesn't have all the scoring accolades like a guy like Jordan does, like a guy like Shaq does. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have the assist numbers of the elite point guards, but it's the total package. You know, it's just the fact that, you know, we have a player who is this dominant, has been this dominant for this long, has been this consistently dominant for this long, and has made, you know, he's made 7 finals appearances. That's insane. And I hate the argument of, oh, well, he only won 3 of those 7.
Yeah.
He only won 3 of those 7, but you say that and that, you know, you say that as if that he lost to bad teams once he got there. I mean, right. 2011, yeah, whatever. But 2 Spurs teams and this Warriors team are the other 3 finals losses. Like, really, there's only 1 finals that you can look at and you can say, okay, LeBron definitely, you know, should take some criticism for the fact that his team lost in that. I mean,
was that the first year in Miami? Yeah.
Yeah, and then that's Dallas title.
Right, the Dallas title. But then, like, yeah, the Spurs, like, one of the greatest passing teams of all time he came up against. Another time, I don't know, I think this was the other was that the same time when they had to turn off the AC to get him to be exhausted? I forget.
Yeah, I think that was 2014. No, that was 2013.
13, okay. Sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. What were you going to say?
But, yeah, I mean, every time I hear that argument of that, I just want to point to 2007. I'm just going to read you off a few of the names of players who were playing big minutes on that 2007 Cavs team.
Please do.
So we got LeBron, second most in minutes per game, or in minutes per game in the playoffs, would have been Larry Hughes.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Zydrin Ilgauskas, who actually was probably the second best player on the team.
Yeah, for sure.
Or Sasha Pavlovich. 5th, Drew Gooden. 6th, a 24-year-old Anderson Varejão. 7th, a 20-year-old Daniel Gibson. Like,
that's insane.
Granted, Varejão and Gibson, they had pretty good careers.
Yeah.
That's not when they were at their best. You got Drew Gooden playing huge minutes. You've got Sasha Pavlovich basically playing shooting guard minutes, defending usually defending one of the other team's best wing players. This is basically a lineup with 2 players who I think were good enough to get rotation minutes on that Spurs team.
Yeah.
I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear the 3 and 4 comments. Like, it just, No.
Yeah, it's kind of unfair. It's very when you read that, it makes everyone who's listening to this should be ashamed of themselves for saying it, if they've ever said it. that's a really unfair team. That's even worse than the 2001 Sixers team that Iverson took the championship.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Sixers again. Me and the Sixers, I can't help it. Anyway, well, listen, like, we're not being LeBron apologists here or creating a false narrative. I mean, that actually was the team he played with and made it to the championships the first time. But about this year, like, do you think he's got a legit chance for another MVP?
I think he's definitely got a legit chance. I mean, the fact that he's like completely kind of retooled his role in the offense, I think is the biggest thing that does it for me. The Cavs have been playing at this really high level, and a lot of it has come because of the fact that LeBron has taken a step back from the scoring role and has become more of a facilitator. It's opened up opportunities for their other players to be great. Kyrie Irving's having the best season of his career. Kevin Love is having the best season of his career outside of that 2014 season with the Timberwolves.
Mm-hmm.
Channing Frye is having a ridiculous season. Tristan Thompson's having probably the second best year of his career. Like, everybody on this team is clicking on all cylinders, and it's because of LeBron. It's because LeBron's been able to find guys in the right spots. It's because he's allowed Love to be able to get those primary scoring opportunities. It's because, you know, him and Kyrie have this brilliant offensive symbiosis that just leads to both of them being able to perform at the best level or at the best of their abilities. I think that him being on the ball and initiating things more, you know, it bends the defense a little bit more in ways that open things up for guys like Thompson, guys like Iman Shumpert, guys like Frye, who have been playing really well this year.
With the one exception being JR, who's not been playing really well, right? Has he come around yet?
You know, he's had a few games in the past couple of weeks that have been pretty solid. He had a pretty strong game in the Grizzlies game, where Kyrie was sitting. I think he had 23 points. He's coming back around, but I think a lot of that has to do with the contract situation and the fact that, you know, you've got J.R. Smith playing himself into shape, which is a terrifying prospect.
Right.
So of course he's not playing well. But just the overall makeup of the team's success, a lot of it's stemming from LeBron, and I think that's why he should be in the conversation. I don't think he's going to win it this year. I think it's going to be one of either Westbrook and all of his triple doubles, or James Harden if he continues to do everything that he's doing for the Rockets and the Rockets continue to be this good.
Right.
I think one of those two will take it, but he's definitely. I would definitely have him third on my ballot right now, probably ahead of both Durant and Curry from Golden State, and behind Westbrook and Harden. Just because, you know, he's taking more of kind of a passive approach to being the MVP, where Harden and Westbrook have been these very active, you know, universal talents. LeBron's taking kind of a passive way to get into this conversation, but he's very much in the conversation.
Yeah, I would agree with that totally. And I think for LeBron, it probably is an award that matters much less for him because, like, again, it's the regular season, and they're pretty much coasting. They're this good right now, and they're coasting. He's trying to save his energy, and he's working toward the playoffs, and that's when he's going to turn it on. Like you mentioned about his defense earlier, we're going to see that defense again come playoff time. He's, you know, I'm not saying he's checked out. The Cavs aren't checked out by any means, but they haven't turned it up yet. They have another gear to get to. And, yeah. You know, if he
no,
was going to...
No, he's pretty checked out defensively.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not as bad as last year. Last year, you could tell basically from about mid-December until about the first week of April, he was absolutely checked out defensively unless it was a big game. His off the ball defense was very bad. This year it's been better, and you know, it hasn't been as obvious that he's right. kind of taking that time off, but you know, he's still not operating at an elite level on the defensive end, or even, you know, some games he's not even operating at a acceptable level from what we would expect from him.
Well, and still, I think that, you know, that's as a result of, like, he's averaged, you know, he's been to six straight finals. He's averaged an entire season more playing than anybody else in the league at this point, right? So he's got one season up on everybody in the same amount of time. That's an insane amount of playing time. That's a huge drain on your body. And the other thing is, like, again, I think that he's obviously very aware of his own legacy and knows that, like, we do judge the greatest of all time by how many titles you've got, you know? So he's obviously going to keep something in the bag until the playoffs come and the finals come. And I don't really begrudge him for that. I mean, I think his defense is probably where it needs to be for now, you know? I don't think he's certainly not a drag on the team defensively.
This year he's in a lot better place. Last year it was affecting the team's overall defense.
That might also have been, like, as a result of, like, switching coaches and everything, too. That's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. I wanted to ask about, like, so Lou, as a coach, he's gotten them over the hump. And he took over, what, mid-season last year? It's closer to the beginning of the season.
Yeah, like late January last year.
Okay, so late January, right. So right around, you know, like a month from now. And the team seems to have gelled in a way that wasn't happening under David Blatt. Now, my question is, do you really think that... Because, like, LeBron has a way of making his coaches look like geniuses. My question is, like, is Tyronn Lue that much better of a coach than David Blatt, or is he just better at managing his players? Like, it seems like they rallied around him because he's more of a player's coach, and he seems like he's... Because he's not that far removed from playing, you know? What do you think? What are your thoughts? I don't... You know, the coaching thing, like, I've never coached. I don't understand the game well enough to ever try and coach a game. But what are your thoughts about it?
I think you hit the nail on the head. He's not a better coach than David Blatt. I think he's a better fit for this team. You know, I'm kind of in a unique spot to talk about Blatt, just because I do cover the Euro stuff pretty closely, and mm-hmm. I've followed him before and I've followed him since, because he's back over in Turkey now. David Blatt's a really good coach. He gets the most out of players at the European level. He does a really good job of showcasing guys who play like LeBron. Meaning that he's really good working with guys who are kind of dribble drive wings. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's adaptable strategically. He doesn't mind changing his system to fit his players' needs. You know, he's a really good technical coach. He's not a very good fit at managing the locker room style of an elite NBA team. You know, if David Blatt had come in and he was coaching what the Cavs were in 2013, 2014, I think he would have fared a lot better. Mm-hmm. Than with that LeBron team. Lou, I think, is also a very good technical coach. I don't think he's as good as Blatt, but he's done a fantastic job with some of the adjustments that he's made in games, some of the adjustments that he's made over the course of a series. I think that he's done a really good job on that end. But the main reason that he took them to this next level in the playoffs and was able to get them and has them connecting so well this season, he just reaches guys. He's really good at managing LeBron and his role in the locker room. He's been great with Kyrie Irving. He's been fantastic with J.R. Smith. And, you know, even down the line, managing the minutes and managing the roles of the older guys like Mike Dunleavy, Richard Jefferson, James Jones, being able to help those guys kind of manage, you know, okay, here's when you're going to get your playing time. Here's how you're going to help us in key situations. And here's how you're going to help us when we're practicing, when we're on the buses, when we're on planes, at team meals, these types of things. I think that he's really good at using his veterans as an extension of himself.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to reach some of the younger players or some of the more standoffish players. So I really think that, you know, and a lot of that does, I think, come from the fact that he played, the fact that he's coming from the Doc Rivers tree, which that's always been one of the best things about Doc as a coach, is he does a really, really good job of managing his locker room and creating team unity.
Right.
And Lou's taking some of those lessons. And, you know, I think he's just a guy that has been in a bunch of locker rooms. He played with a bunch of different teams in a bunch of different situations over the course of his career. He's just a guy that understands that side of the game. And I think when you put that with his, on-court, you know, technical coaching skills, that's what's made him the big difference here. I think he's, he doesn't get the credit that you know, other guys do because of the fact that he has LeBron, but he's definitely a top 10 coach in my mind.
Yeah, and it seems like other teams were actually considering him for head coach too. I think the Cavs were happy to have him on their bench and then be able to promote him. But then, you know, that I totally agree with everything you're saying there. It makes me think, like, what do you think the greatest moment of his basketball career has been? And I wrote this to you when we were talking about, like, what we were going to talk about. Do you think it was, like, being the coach that brought the only team in NBA history back from a 3-1 deficit to win the championship? Or do you think it was winning that championship with the Lakers in 2001 as a player? I've got to imagine, for me, you probably always, like, divert to being a player and actually doing it on the court, but still, as a coach, that has to be an amazing, amazing feeling and an amazing achievement, you know?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, that's a really tough question to answer, because I do feel like the winning it as a player is what most guys would take. But I mean, he's on one of the most famous basketball plays of the millennium. And it's not because of anything he did well from that finals. So, you know, I don't know if he thinks about that and factors that into his decision.
Just so everybody who doesn't know what we're talking about, the Iverson step over in 2001 in the playoffs, when Lou was guarding him and Iverson hit the three and Lou fell down and Iverson stepped over him, and it's been immortalized in, like, posters and photos everywhere. You can just look it up on the internet. It's great. But go on, I'm sorry.
But yeah, I just feel like, you know, it's a very interesting question, and one that I hope that he gets asked at some point. Is just what meant more to you, winning as you know, kind of a fringe rotation player on the, you know, one of the most dominant playoff teams that we've ever seen, or stepping in midseason and leading this team as one of the biggest factors in them beating or being able to beat the best team of all time?
It's a very interesting
question that I don't know the answer either.
Well, here's my gift to you. If you ever get to talk to him, take that question and ask him.
I might try to get my editor at Fear the Sword, who covers games regularly. I should see if I can slide that in if he goes and covers a game.
Do it and give me a full report. I want to know what he says. Yeah, he was a fringe player on that Lakers team. Not a fringe player, but I mean, you know, he was coming off the bench, right?
Yeah.
And he
wasn't playing a ton.
No. And he was important to that team, but that team would have won the championship regardless. I got to feel like it maybe being the coach of that Cavs team last year is historic. It will go down in the pages of NBA history, and he was the head coach. That's got to be more important, right?
Yeah, I don't know. There's definitely been other guys who have been in similar situation throughout NBA history. I mean, your boy Billy Cunningham, one as a player, one as a coach with the Sixers. So there's definitely been guys who've done both, but never one who is kind of like a kind of that far down the depth chart as the player, or one who obviously beat the 73-9 Warriors when they had a 3-1 lead and the unanimous MVP.
Yeah. Speaking of,
let this conversation distract you from.
Speaking of the Warriors, so the Cavs and the Warriors are playing Christmas Day. Are you excited?
I haven't really gotten up for the Cavs Warriors Christmas games. Last year I didn't, and you know, I'm not really up for it this year just because, you know, the Warriors are probably going to win. and I don't think that there's a real strong, obviously this year, I think there is more than last year, just because, you know, the Cavs fired David Blatt like a week after this game. So it kind of threw everything to the wind. But I think if everybody's playing, in this one's going to go a longer way to, you know, telling us a little bit about how the Cavs match up with this Warriors team. So I'm more excited about this year than last year, just because I think we're going to be able to tell a little bit more. But at the same time, I mean, I could very easily see the Warriors just getting a slight advantage, and then the Cavs just kind of folding, either because they get frustrated or because they just don't want to show a ton.
Yeah. I was going to say, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I was going to say, like, yeah, I mean, the Warriors obviously have more to prove at this point, right? They need to come out and show that, look, we're not going to lay down. You're not going to beat us again. Right. And and they have a harder conference. So if the Cavs come out and they're getting beat a little bit, they can coast. It's fine. They're going to take the East. It's probably not even a question right now at this point. I definitely think the Warriors have more to prove. What were you going to say? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off again.
Yeah. I think that they definitely do, because, oh man, if they lose this game, the pressure's on the Warriors, just because I think of the situation. I mean, it's different than the Cavs losing Christmas Day to the Warriors last year.
Right.
The Cavs, you know, they weren't good enough to beat the Warriors, and then in that game they still weren't good enough to beat the Warriors. The Cavs didn't add a generational talent or in the interim between those two events occurring.
Right, exactly.
I think that's a huge part of it. And then also the fact that, you know, psychologically, this is going to be kind of a little bit of a dagger if the Cavs are able to win at Golden State. Just because this is, are they really, it's going to take a lot to kind of reconcile, okay, that whatever, the finals were fluky, we're better, we can handle this team, and then just, oh no, we still couldn't do it.
Yeah, adding Kevin Durant and you still can't beat them, that, oh my God, I could actually see that loss maybe putting them into a little bit of a tailspin for a few games to come. I think they would correct it, obviously, really quickly, but I definitely think the Warriors have more to prove here. Yeah, for sure. And you know, as a Cavs fan, if you were a Cavs fan like you are, I wouldn't be upset at a Cavs loss, honestly. It's just, you know, it'll be a fun game regardless. I would love to see them both come out swinging and prove, you know, or act like they have something to prove and give the fans like a really entertaining game. But ultimately, I think it definitely means more for the Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, there are gonna be people who will take this seriously if the Cavs lose, and the narrative will kind of be, oh, the Cavs aren't going to be able to do this. They're going to be able to beat the Warriors if they have to play them again in the finals. They're another step behind this team. But I think the people who pay attention to kind of how this team operates on that kind of chemistry level and on that kind of game to game level, I think that there's gonna be a good number of Cavs fans who are gonna say, doesn't really matter. We still have another game against this team in the regular season.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter for the playoffs at all, and we still have the title.
And they still have LeBron.
Yeah.
And as long as you got LeBron, you've got a damn good shot.
Exactly. Every day that we get closer to the finals is another day that Andre Iguodala gets older.
And that's true.
It's another day that the Warriors still don't have a functional center outside of Draymond Green.
Also like true.
There are definitely you know, silver linings for the Cavs regardless of outcome in this game.
Yeah, and honestly, it's no guarantee that the Warriors will even make it. Who knows? The Spurs look really good.
Yeah, that Raptors Clippers finals is going to be pretty exciting.
That would be really that's going to be a great series if it gets there. One other thing I did want to mention though is did you see that Cavs Rick Astley tribute video they did? Not tribute video, but like parody video.
I did.
Oh my God, that thing was amazing. What'd you think? I want your thoughts.
This Cavs team is so fun. they just do not care. And they're kind of embodying the fan base a little bit, because this summer was a pretty petty time in Cleveland.
Yeah.
With the 3-1 jokes, things like that, poking fun at the Warriors players during the Olympics.
Even the way up to Halloween, when LeBron had his Halloween party, he was still doing 3-1 like gravestone cookies or something.
Exactly. I mean, there's been that stuff like that. There have been a few interviews that have been kind of in a similar vein. This team's just really loose, and it affords them the ability to be able to do this stuff which is great, because I mean, this collection of players, not only are they absurdly talented, and not only are they one of the best teams in the league, like, this is just a fun group of guys to follow. I mean, you got LeBron, who's one of the corniest guys in the league. Richard Jefferson, who's just this fantastic dude to watch do interviews and things. If you don't follow him on Snapchat, you absolutely have to, just because he's hysterical. You've got Kyrie Irving, who's the super chill guy. Tristan Thompson, who's secretly one of the funnier players in the league. And they all get along, and it's just so fun. It's so fun to watch, like, the social media side of things for this team, because they, they seem really, A, really relaxed, and B, they're just funny. Like, this is just a funny, creative, happy-go-lucky group of guys, and that's really great to see. Mainly because not every NBA team has that. I mean, even the Warriors, even the Warriors don't seem like they're having fun.
No, the Warriors. Yeah, the Warriors kind of just, like, rub it in your face sort of when they're having fun. You know, the Cavs are just – they just seem like they're genuinely just enjoying each other's company and having a good time. That video was – man, it cracked me up. It was awesome. And some of the guys actually looked really good in those 80s uniform – or 80s attire. Like,
oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's the way Kyrie dresses all the time anyway, right? And JR, man, he was wearing some really shiny shirt. It looked really good on him.
their Halloween costumes the past couple of years have been on point.
Yeah,
this is also a very well dressed team.
Yeah, by the way, I love the fashion shows leading into the arenas, man. It's like the best thing for me. It's like, damn, I gotta steal some of these looks if I could. But anyway, man, we should probably wrap it up. We're going a little bit long here, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Trevor, thank you so much for coming on, and I'm definitely going to have you on again when the playoffs come, and we could talk some more Cavs and see how they're doing.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, great. This has been fun.
Yeah, plug your stuff one more time, and we'll get out of here.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter at IllegalScreens. You can find my Cavs writing at Fear the Sword. You can find my other writing at Fansided's The Step Back, which is going to be more draft related, more European basketball related. There's a little Cavs stuff in there as well. That's kind of it.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. And I'll be in touch, man.
All right.
Take care.
Take care.
Well, there you go, everybody. It was Trevor Magnotti. You can follow him. And you can also follow the Superflight Podcast at Superflight Pod on Twitter and Stitcher on iTunes and Google Play and yada, 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 wherever else you find these things. Anyway, so that was this week's episode. And we'll have more for you coming up. I think we're going to have a couple of return guests. You know, maybe the week between Christmas and New Year's, I can get one out for you so you guys have something to do while you're being miserable going back to work. anyway, it's been real, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.